How's it going?
Pretty good. I'm trying to remember what I want to talk about.
Bowling?
Bowling.
You love bowling.
My
new favorite pastime.
Yeah.
We had a good time bowling the other night.
Bowling's hard.
It was hard, especially when the lights went out and all of a sudden the pins were glowing. And I didn't know if that was like we had one too many beers or...
System failure or like bowling alley theme.
You know, one time at the end, remember when everything messed up? The thing would never reset the pins correctly.
I don't remember that.
So one time we went and we hit like 8 and then like the 2 pins were supposed to be reset for the next frame, the last shot of the frame. I don't even know the terminology. Clearly, I'm a professional bowler, but the machine couldn't do it. It was like, and then like the pins dropped and then the thing came down again and just picked them up and just tried again. And the pins kept dropping. So then the guy came down, he just walked down and he did something and then it just worked. So like, what would be a failure that you could just walk down and like push a button and now this mechanical thing that wasn't working?
Well, those machines are probably expensive and like they probably don't want to replace those. They probably want to replace those every 10 years.
But if they fail in such a predictable way that like you can push, someone can just walk down and push a button and fix it, I feel like there's something more going on there. I don't know.
Bowling alleys must be tough business. It requires a lot of land, a lot of technology.
Shoe cleaning. Smelly shoes. You know, customers coming in complaining about getting the gout after they spend a little too long there. Yeah. It's a good time, though. So, we've been thinking a lot about data loading, as usual. We were talking about it for a couple of reasons. We were working on some Rails code last week, and Active Record is awesome.
Yeah.
It's awesome in a way that I didn't fully understand until we started thinking about this like declarative rendering stuff, I think. Because the idea with declarative rendering is that, you know, when you're using something like handlebars and you're able to declare as much of your interface as possible, the tooling can do so much of the work for you. And it makes your code more resilient to change because your code more closely resembles what your interface is trying to actually be. And so if you say something like, when I click on this button, open up a modal, and if that's, I mean, you could just say that, and that's part of your program, that's part of your software. That's something that someone on your team could understand who's not a coder. And if you just said that, and somehow the tooling was able to take that, when I click on this button, open a modal, and take that and actually just do all the implementation, like that's what you actually code, that's your API to this thing. You don't care if you're using a div or a ptag, you don't care if you're using JavaScript, mm-hmm. right? It just takes that and turns it into the program. There's something really powerful about that because that implementation can just change so much, but that thing is still going to be true. That's still an accurate description of your software.
It's interesting. I care less about the non-coder understanding it. I care way more about being able to refactor it easily.
Yeah.
So the underlying implementation can
change. Being able to change. Yeah. Right. But that's the reason why is because the details of the coder now does abstract away those implementation details. So in my opinion, like if you're thinking about if you're trying to say, how can I make this code as declarative as possible? And if you already buy that like declarative programming is good for all these reasons, then the next thing is, how can I make my APIs as declarative as possible? I think the best way to answer that question, to approach those APIs, is to say, how would you talk about this
100%
with someone who doesn't know code? How would you talk about this to your users? What do your users expect here? So yeah, it's just interesting. You know, it made me think of like natural language processing, or like, what are they called? Natural language APIs, or, you know, like if you're talking to an Echo or a Siri or something, and that's basically, you know, turn the TV on and watch the Cowboys.
That's the best interface.
That's the best interface. Cause that is the declaration of what you want, and you don't care about any of the implementation details. So, this came up because in Rails, I was just taking a look at like video events in Embermap system. And I was like, oh yeah, yesterday's video events. And you know, in Rails, the API is so great. It's like date yesterday. You know, so you get like video view where date is yesterday. That's like what you're basically saying. I mean, even more so, it'd be like, yeah, yesterday's video views. That's something that a system could understand, could comprehend. But it's so great because once you're in the Rails console, of course, you've done some setup, like you've made sure your database is running and all that stuff. But a lot of that can be taken care of for you these days, right? Once you're there and you just say video views where date is yesterday, there's just so much you're not thinking about. And even though we have some good, I mean, I love Ember Data, has some great APIs that are natural. Like we try to get there, set the user's first name to Sam and save him. Like that's a pretty close thing to what we actually code. Mm-hmm. But then you're always thinking about the JSON payload. You're always thinking about the network request.
Well, just thinking about the console. You're in Rails, you can just type stuff, hit enter.
Yeah.
In the browser console, now you're thinking about promises. You're thinking about callbacks.
Yes.
So yeah, even that stuff, just
promises, callbacks, network requests, data transport. Does my server understand the payload? What's it going to look like? I'm going to open up like my payload, and it's, you know, there's just a lot of details that are still there because they haven't been standardized in the way that, for example, SQL has. Mm-hmm. Whereas with that console command in Rails, I'm not thinking about SQL at all, which is great because it's great. Now, of course,
like, get into some things where SQL leaks into the Active Record.
Right.
But it's not, I don't think it's bad. I think you're aware of how the data is like written to disk. So you're thinking about joins.
Right.
And eager loading and includes.
Right.
But it's not, I'm never at a point where I'm writing SQL. Never at a point where I'm thinking like SQL syntax. I'm always thinking in objects,
right?
You know, in Active Record objects.
And I think folks rightfully think about that, but they sometimes take it too far where they're like, oh, every Rails app I've worked on, there's been 5% of it where I've had to jump down into SQL or something like that. And therefore, like people who say, I don't have to learn SQL and I can just write a Rails app, it's actually like a problem. Like you should actually know the underlying stuff. But my point more is like, no, there's a future where you don't. Just like there's a future where we don't have to understand how TCP and HTTP works. So eventually they can be sufficiently abstract. It doesn't have to be perfect, but sufficiently abstracted away to where you don't have to think about it. And most of my Rails work is at that point. But the Ember stuff, you know, it's just got a long way to... I mean, any of the JavaScript stuff.
Yep.
So this was interesting, too, because just thinking about this stuff, and I was on Twitter, I was looking at Dan Abramov and Michael Jackson were talking about React and working with React with plain objects and arrays. And they were saying that's still one of their favorite features of React, is being able to render something without wrapping it in like KVO, observable, anything like that. And then they were saying like a lot of people, when they come from other tools, whether it's like a backend framework like Rails or something like Ember that has models, they're like, so what do we use for models in our React apps? And they're like, well, you have like objects and arrays in JavaScript. And I remember hearing this kind of when React first came out. And it was like, again, a big selling point because it was kind of a pushback against the complexity of larger frameworks and saying, let's just start simple with a render function that can just take JavaScript objects and arrays, right? But I was surprised to see them say that, like, this was just like a day or two ago. And I was surprised because, like, these days, if you ask people what their stack is, at least, again, I'm not a React developer, but I follow enough that I think I can kind of understand where things are, where trends are, and... You know, today you would say I'm using React, but I'm also using Apollo, or I'm using Redux, or something like that.
Right.
Because eventually, and kind of the way I thought about it is like, yeah, objects and arrays are not enough. Like, they're enough, of course, they can always be, like, your data structures at the bottom can be objects and arrays. But to say we're just using objects and arrays, but then you have something like a cache, it's like, okay, the cache holds objects and arrays instead of model instances. But like the cache still has its own API. So you're thinking about, basically when it comes to your data store, you've gone beyond objects and arrays.
Right. Eventually you're going to run into a UI problem that you need something more than objects and arrays.
Right.
Even though whatever you need is going to be implemented as objects
exactly.
and arrays. So you're going to need some API. You know, I like the example of like the user has their first name listed at the top of the
right.
screen and then they change their first name in a form. You want it to update everywhere it's used.
Right. And you can use lowest common ancestor and hoist that to top. But if you are doing something like current user, which is used basically everywhere, it ends up being hoisted at the very top. And then also you want something like a cache that can work when you tear down a component and come back. So those problems naturally come up in all these apps, which is why solutions like Redux and Apollo exist. But yeah, I guess maybe it's also this idea that, like, I think the way my mind works is, like, if I'm going to hit those problems, I want something now that is just going to work when I get there, instead of, like, starting with just my own approach. And then when I get there, like, adding something new, and now I have, like, multiple ways of doing data. My mind, I think, works like, yeah, I know I'm going to need current user. I know I'm going to want to, like, prefetch data for a page and load it fast. So I know I'm going to want an identity map. You know, I'm thinking in terms of like relational models, because that's what I do data on in the back end in our servers. And so I just want something like an ORM from the beginning. Like, that to me, that just makes sense. But I think it was just interesting kind of like seeing this discussion on Twitter, because it's not how everyone thinks or works.
I haven't followed this, but if I was to argue why you would want objects and arrays, I think I would start with the argument that, like, yeah, of course you want models. The problem is if you get into a bad abstraction
right.
with models, your life is going to be miserable.
Right.
And so it's better to have the clunky object and array solution over,
yeah, you
over
just a bad fetch. Abstraction. You just do a fetch to some endpoint and you render some data. And then once you get to a point where you're adding a feature and you realize like this part of the UI is out of sync over there, you just deal with it then.
And yeah. I think that eventually, I mean, I hope, but even every JavaScript community, even the React community will find these sort of like the higher level abstraction. Of course they will.
Right. I mean, they have in a lot of these libraries, but yeah, I think it's just interesting seeing the mentalities of the different communities. Again, if you're in Rails, if you're teaching someone Rails and you're saying how to display data, like a list of posts start out. No authors, nothing, just post models. You're going to create a post model. You're going to have a post database table. It's going to have the right names and everything. It's going to have an ID. It's not going to just say, oh, let's create like a JSON blob and throw it in a database column. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course. And not only that, you would never let them write SQL.
Right.
Because it's like you're teaching them Rails.
Right, exactly.
So you would say post.all, you know, all the ORM stuff.
Exactly. But I think you're right that, you know, the abstraction is maybe harder on the front end because you're dealing with asynchrony and all this stuff, caching in a way that maybe people didn't think. You know, again, like Ember data is awesome, but it's not 100% right now. So getting locked into a bad abstraction is bad. And I've seen folks talk about, yeah, it's okay to tell people not to use Ember data. And of course it is. At the same time, you know, we have those stories of people using something like that and kind of using the constraints of something like Ember data or Active Record or like relational database with foreign keys to model their data, and how those constraints help lead yes. to better design and avoid problems down the road. So there's kind of an interesting tension there, I think.
Yeah. And I think we're both on the side of like you said earlier, just default to Ember data. You get nudged in the right direction.
Right. So kind of bringing this back to the data fetching stuff, I think it's just interesting because, yeah, like a lot of this. Yeah, again, with the rendering stuff, like, it's pretty interesting how the right abstraction can really completely eliminate whole classes of APIs, whole classes of imperative code that we don't have to worry about anymore, just from an abstraction. It's kind of interesting because it's not like, when we say improvements in technology, a lot of times it's just how we think about things and how we call things. And that abstraction of rendering like that and not having to worry about the DOM APIs is just so powerful. So I wonder if there's going to be something at the data layer that is going to do something similar, where the data layer, there's going to be an abstraction in the way we like fetch and persist data that goes beyond like using fetch or Ajax or JSON. And it's going to be something that's higher. I mean, even like something like GraphQL is a query language, right? Mm-hmm. But like something like that, that's even more abstract that everyone can share in the same way that everyone shares basically rendering today.
Right.
Like all the frameworks use the same kind of shared abstraction for rendering.
I would absolutely take the yes
yeah.
on this.
Yeah.
I think there's so many ways to load data, you know, fetch, XHR, WebSockets.
The shape of your data.
Where if you could just hide all that yeah. away and like, oh yeah, updates just show up in my store. I don't know how they do
right.
it, but they just show up.
Right.
Like, that's such a win for the application developer.
Totally. And like you think about when you do have a lot of rich schema information on your client, then you can do something like plug it into Firebase. I mean, when we did that, that's amazing. Like mm-hmm. that's the least amount of work you've ever done to do persistence in a web app.
Yep.
Is like you have your Ember data models already, and then you just like install Ember Fire or whatever, and that's it.
Call dot save.
Yeah, call dot save. Right. That's the one thing you have to do. I mean, it's pretty incredible. So, yeah, kind of just something that's been on my mind and will be interesting to see. I think the declarative programming stuff is more forefront in people's minds, and I think that's good because I think that's kind of that's how this stuff is going to get better. Like when I think of Ember, Vue, React, for me, like, or data, like JSON API, okay, GraphQL, we definitely want to check it out. I think there's some awesome ideas there. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of similarities. Like you're talking about tweaks to the shape of data or like how you call it. In my mind, the thing that would be exciting that would make me want to learn it would be this next jump where it's like, now I'm doing something fundamentally different than I was before. It's not just like a bike shedding over an API that's basically doing the same thing.
So it's
like going from Backbone to React.
Okay, so you care less about sort of Glimmer versus Virtual DOM versus X, where to you it's like, okay, these are all great, but the real thing here is the declarative rendering.
Yeah, exactly. And so now none of us are having to like manipulate the DOM anymore. So I would say someone is still doing like Backbone or still doing like imperative code with jQuery, like you should absolutely make the leap to one of the modern frameworks. You know, the differences between the modern frameworks at that level is way less than the difference from that previous stock to the current stock. And of course, things like the ecosystem and the add-ons, all the conventions, all the things we love about Ember matter, but they matter more for like a fit for your team and your personality and how you approach programming, as opposed to something like the declarative rendering stuff, which is literally just going to eliminate the entire previous batch because it's so much better.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, again, I think something like that for data fetching and data persistence will come about that will basically completely replace the previous way of doing things.
That's going to be pretty awesome.
Pretty exciting. Yeah, I really believe that, though, because, again, just once you do this stuff and you see the same stuff over and over again, like, declarative rendering is not the same stuff as a new API for, like, it's not like the difference between inner HTML and .html. So, like, you know, the DOM has, like, element.innerHTML, and jQuery has, like, selector.html, right? Like, .html is nice. Like, jQuery has a lot of nice APIs. .class, and you pass it in, as opposed to, like, class name equals whatever the DOM API
is. And then have to deal with the browsers.
Exactly. But, like, those things are different at a much more superficial level than the declarative rendering stuff.
Right. The declarative, you're talking about the difference between APIs and the difference between, like, mental models of programming.
Yes. Yeah. So I really think, as more people internalize these lessons that we're getting from declarative programming and how much they let us offload to tools, that's naturally going to fall into like the data side. And there's other things I think it'll fall into too. Like, you know, there's rendering. I mean, yeah, there's just other aspects of the program, like the UI component stuff, like how we describe UI components or how we describe like our app at different sizes and like the mapping from like a sketch file to like a program. Like I think there's a lot of stuff there too that's just going to become higher and higher level. But I think the data fetching stuff is like needs to be the next one so that we can just stop wrangling with JSON APIs, custom stuff. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. Data fetching would be awesome. I really like how you phrase it. Like the rendering, the revolution in rendering is going to like leak everywhere.
Right.
And it's going to cause people to think about this stuff when they're working on backends.
I hope so.
That's super exciting. So while we're on the topic of APIs, last week I had opened in our admin area, I had opened the page and I was editing the page. And we have like this wizard style form where you can like click between different routes and edit different parts of like a model graph. And I had been doing this and then I like shut my laptop. I think in the morning you came on, opened it up and you tweaked my edits. I think you like uploaded a new video and had done some like improvements. And then I think that afternoon I opened my laptop, continued to click around, click save. And I think later that day I had asked you to redo the edits that you had made and re-upload the files that you had done. And what happened here was that I had not reloaded the page from mm-hmm. the previous night. So my identity map did not get your changes that you had made that morning. So when I when I'd click save in the afternoon, I had overwritten all of your data.
The last one wins.
The last one wins. and it made me think, like, wow, like, we don't, like, this is just, this is something that you have to account for.
Yeah, you have to allot time and energy and resources for it.
When you're making a server-rendered app, every time you click a section of the page, you're always getting the latest form data, because that form data is rendering
right
from the server at that point in time.
Right.
Or
now, there are obviously times where you're reading a Stack Overflow question, you hit edit, and then you have stale data, and it lets you know
yep.
this page is out of fresh, or PR in GitHub.
Yes.
So you have
GitHub is great.
GitHub is a great example. So you do have to account for that with a server-rendered app. The thing is, the likelihood, the amount of the problem space is reduced because you're necessarily getting fresh data at every interaction. Whereas an Ember app, because of caching, this is actually like the double-edged sword of the identity map, is that because of caching, and if you don't account for that, you can just have that initial version of data.
And I was clicking all around the app.
Interesting. So we didn't have background reload on, basically. At some point, that must have been disabled, or like,
no,
or
the query was within, parent. Exactly. Yeah. I was within a subroute, and the subroute is huge.
Yep.
It's like you can edit each part of the graph.
Yep.
And I was just clicking around there, and we had already loaded the parent route. Yes.
Right.
Parent route loaded the data. So, yeah, it's just like, wow, this is something that, you know, obviously I need to think about it. I was like, man, is there any, like, is there like a better way than the default way of just always working off cache?
Yeah, some default abstractions that they know that can work better. I mean, it makes me think of like error and loading states too. It's the same thing where if you just, by default, there's not going to be anything to handle them.
I was wondering if there's, is there just some component that I can put at the bottom of the page? It's like, if you've had this open for 24 hours, it just tells you like, hey, you've had this open for 24 hours.
Or just like reload, automatically reload the models in the store.
Yeah.
You just do like model.reload or something like that.
Yep. Exactly. Yep.
I mean, really, I think, what do we always come back to? The polling stuff, the log entry, event source. That's different than event sourcing, where the client says, I'm on entry 105, and the server says, you're up to date, or here's 106 to 110.
Yeah, I mean, it's different, but it all comes, you're in an event sourcing app, you're going to be thinking about this stuff. So it's, I would say it's part of the larger
right.
event sourcing problem. It falls within that sphere.
Gotcha. So that to me, I mean, that's where my brain goes just based on our past conversations. Like,
I feel like that's a lot of code.
But that's the thing where it's like, it's a lot of code, but I really believe that there is an abstraction that gives you like the object-oriented interface on top, the stateful objects, and like under the hood uses event sourcing. And like that helps you when it comes time to do like undo and redo or revisions, like you already have all the data.
History.
And then also with this problem of stale clients, because it's just a log. And we know if you have logs, like how to update clients. It's very simple. You just say, I'm on this entry.
Well, you just know too that I'm stale.
You just know, right, exactly. How would you know that otherwise?
I ask for the next entry and it says there's no next entry and I know I'm up
right.
to date.
Exactly. So I really feel like, you know, you could do something simple where the Rails app could tell you like last updated app of any record in the database, basically. You could keep, that's like as a poor man's log.
Yeah.
And then like the client can say how much, if there's any relevant data. You could do something like on a per model level. So if you're like on a page and you have like five models being shown, then, what those models, are they up to date? Are they stale? Like there's some abstractions that you could do there. But I agree, like it's important to get that at a level where every single application developer doesn't have to think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was embarrassing. I mean, embarrassing that our app does that.
Yeah. And the thing is also like, let's say you're editing a form and someone else makes a change. Like, what do you do in that case?
Yeah,
so it's actually not always like a simple, just update the client
right.
the way it is in like MySQL,
right.
where it's like you want the data to just represent the master. So you just update it. But sometimes in UI, there's a decision point to make.
Yep.
But I do think there could still be a default that says, yeah, just update the latest. I mean, you know.
I like starting with like the updated at.
Yeah.
The event sourcing thing is really appealing to me, but that's also like, that's an architecture change. That's not just an Ember install thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I like something that, you know, you can say what models matter on this page, and you check their updated at, and you can fire an action when they change.
Right.
And then me as a developer, I can think about this.
Right.
Yeah,
that would be cool.
Cool. I'd love to hear what other people are doing.
Yeah,
here,
absolutely.
Because I feel like this is something that affects every Ember app. And
having an action that's pretty neat, like model did change or something like that, and then you get to decide whether to roll it up or not. You know, I mean, this is also part of like when you edit a form and you're just and editing the single model in the identity map, you get stuck in certain UI places where you want to do like pessimistic or optimistic UI.
Right.
So if you want to do pessimistic UI, you have to do a draft model. You have to just make up your own thing. So if Ember Data had that notion built into it, which I think people are thinking about this, then you could do something like model did change and like model dot flush all pending changes, like or model dot like whatever. You know, you have two notions of two concepts of the model, like the canonical store one, server one, and then you have like a local one.
Right. You can do this with things like buffered proxy and change set. Where it sort of breaks down is on the relationship side, because you're never really just thinking in terms of a model. You're thinking in terms of a graph.
Right.
And yeah.
Right. So you want like a fork store. Like you want like a fork store, and like you.
By the way, we should have a stopwatch, and every time we start talking about Ember Data, we should see how long it takes one of us to bring up a store forking.
it's like how every philosophical or like political discussion ends in someone talking about Hitler. It's like, yeah. It's like the same thing.
Hitler, store forking. I think they're a little, you know.
If the word data comes out of our mouth, it's like, yeah, once you get to store forking, you can just listen to every episode of the Embermap podcast and just take a shot every time you hear store forking.
Yeah, there
it'd
you
be
go.
A great Friday night activity. I think we only have like 20, 30 hours of podcasting, so, you know. Like a good way to make new friends, I think. yeah, that would be great. So someone should build that, all of that. Event sourcing and Rails hooked up into a live data source via action cable with store forking on the front, on the client. That's all we need, really.
Yeah, and also make it work. So as a Rails programmer, you're never thinking in terms of event.
Oh, yeah.
Thinking in terms of, you know, object-oriented programming.
Yeah, I think you can get there. Also, we've talked about this before. The only way mutations happen in a Rails server are from network requests. So,
wow.
So they're changing the keg.
Nice. So they heard us talking about store forking. They brought the keg up.
So if the only way mutations happen is from a network request, you could just like save all of those, and that's basically your log right there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the data is like, you know, that is a log, but then your database is like a materialized view of the log of all network requests.
Yeah.
So you could effectively share those network requests with every client, and if they knew how to update the data, but that seems like a lot of work. Really, you just need like snapshots of the records over time. Anyway, someone else is going to build this one day. I know they are. I know you can get it to the point where you can do what we do in Rails, but under the hood, it uses event source. So you don't have to think about it.
There are some Ruby libraries that are giving you access. They have a log table.
Yeah.
And they give you models that get recreated from the log table. I think you as a programmer still have to think in terms of, oh, I'm writing an event-sourced application.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are trade-offs you have to make. Like, what if my log table is 10 million rows and I'm scanning all that for, like, I'm recreating a model by scanning the entire table.
Right. That actually matters.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be nice if it didn't matter.
Right.
If it didn't matter, then...
If it didn't matter at all. And there are some log storage database systems that do kind of like, they do roll up all of a model's changes and they snapshot that model. So I think Kafka does this. I know Kafka does this. But it's still...
So it gives you something to query as a current state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can have like basically like an index and the latest index. So you would have like model name and ID and the latest state would be there. But you could also go back and get the history.
Right.
I still think...
It's just too much. The implementation is going to come out in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And I like it. I like this form of thinking, but I also like... the productivity that default Rails gives me out of the box.
Right.
So I have no interest in switching over to these systems.
Right. Even though conceptually they appeal to you
Like
more correct in certain ways.
Yeah.
Of ways to just store mutations over time.
Yep. I think yeah. So absolutely, you can make like the theoretical snap your fingers correctness argument, but then I think there's going to be other stuff I run into, like maybe there's some Rails gems that kind of like ship with a bunch of models and they're not aware of this log system. So I do want, you know, I don't want a framework fight.
Right.
And I think some of this stuff is still framework fighting a little too much.
It would be cool if you could do that at like the active record level. If active record could be implemented using logs under the hood.
Yep.
Because then that's already the contract in the Rails ecosystem.
And there are a few libraries that's what they do.
I see.
But again, I think it's still, you still end up, as a programmer, it's not, you know that you're working on an event-driven application.
Right.
Log-based application.
So. Right.
Yeah.
A man can dream.
Yeah. So just like store forking, we can talk about fast boot.
Okay.
Actually, this isn't about fast boot. This is a more like higher level thing. So the way you get fast boot into your Ember application is you Ember install Ember CLI fast boot. And that just makes it so you run Ember S, and in development, fast boot just works. It does. It's amazing. That brings in Ember CLI fast boot has like the Ember CLI integration. It also brings in all the fast boot libraries. So that's like you're installing fast boot in your app. That's your entry point. There's a lot of different fast boot libraries that kind of get rolled up into that Ember CLI fast boot add-on. And one of them is the actual fast boot code itself, the actual thing that renders your app on the server rendering of your application. And that's
the thing that runs your Ember application
on the server.
Right.
And that's called like Ember Fastboot or Fastboot. I forget the name of that NPM package. I needed to make a change to that. So I had a bug that I was working through and it lived in that library. So what I did is I made a change, opened a PR. But before that PR got merged, I wanted to use that in my Ember app. So I wanted to use like Ember Fastboot or Fastboot, but how do I get that installed in my Ember app? Because I don't install that add-on directly. I can't just open package.json and point it at a GitHub repo. So I was thinking, like, do I fork Ember CLI fastboot? Have Ember CLI fastboot change the dependency of fastboot in Ember CLI fastboot, and then install that forked version into my app? And this was like, figured I'd ask you because you have a lot more add-on experience.
Yeah.
But like, how do you do this? This seems like a common thing in Ember with like add-ons that
transitive kind of, dependencies.
Yeah, that ship with other add-ons, especially for like these big package stuff.
Yeah, I would have to sit down and play around. But isn't there a thing called resolutions in package.json? Did you try that? I think there's a keyword in resolutions that npm respects that says. Any dependency that npm is going to get once it crawls the graph, you know, it has an algorithm for figuring out which version based on, you know, the versions in your package.json, and then those packages and those packages, as we know, way down the line to the black hole of the universe.
The 15 gigabyte modules file.
So its resolution is figuring out the versions of all that, but I'm pretty sure resolution serves as a top-level override that says, okay, Lodash, I need it to be 1.1.5 for this branch name.
Oh.
And I think what will happen is you're going to do that. And then, so let's say you have like Fastboot and it's like Ryan Toe / my Fastboot branch. What's going to happen, I think, is once it goes through Ember CLI Fastboot, looks at its dependencies, it's going to say, oh, Ember CLI Fastboot depends on Fastboot package from version 1 to 2. And it's like, your thing is not version 1 to 2. So it might say there's a conflict because what you've specified as your resolution doesn't work with a transitive dependency of one of your other dependencies. But you might be able to say that's okay. Like there might be a way to say like just use that, or it might just use that and warn you. So I'm pretty sure that's what resolutions is.
Okay, that's perfect. That's exactly what I wanted.
I think it would apply not only, I know I've used it for top level, but I think it also applies to like child dependencies.
Perfect. Perfect.
I think.
Okay, I will try this at some point. And
also,
back.
Like, doesn't node modules let you have multiple versions of things? Wasn't that part of the whole recursive design?
Yeah. Yes.
So I wonder if the resolutions only applies to the top level dependency, and then a child would have its own, and node would be happy NPM would be happy because it lets you do it.
But it seems like in a world of these bigger node packages,
you have to
packaging up other smaller things. It's really nice how Fastboot is packaged,
right?
Where you have this big thing, and then you have all the little things in their own repos.
I mean, you could imagine doing the same thing for Ember CLI, right? Where it's just like Ember CLI, and they all point to like all those things.
Yep.
But I think they've said the reason they don't do that maybe is because of this problem. Maybe it's just like because it's easier to just change it if it's in your top level thing. Anyways, I would say
it's almost like you want a Fastboot eject, where like if you're using a package that packages other things, you can eject it and get access to it.
Yeah, but then you're responsible for
it. Right, so then going forward, I'm going to do this for years.
So you don't want that. Sucks, yeah. I think there's a way to do what you're trying to do.
Okay.
And I think it might have to do with resolution. So,
well,
yeah,
that's where I can start. That's
you should report back for sure.
Nice.
You were doing Fastboot because we've started serving embermap.com to clients.
Yeah, yep. Which is super exciting.
Super exciting. So until now, we've only had our Fastboot code served to bots because the reason we originally got it is because we wanted Twitter cards and Slack cards to render when people would share EmberMap links.
Yep.
But we didn't want users visiting their browser to have a runtime dependency on the Fastboot generation because reasons.
You can't.
So why can't you?
So the Ember app still has to run and render somewhere, and it's slow when it runs on your server. I mean, just think about, like, your server is what? Like, 2 cores, 512 megabytes. You're just going to render everything. You're going to render all these components, computed properties. You're going to set up all the
KDO. It's like setting up the Ember application and everything, and it's going to do what is done in most people's modern browsers on their computers, which are faster.
Yep. So this is also part of our architecture, but we tend to write a lot of components.
Right.
So we are always breaking things up into components.
Right.
And you feel that it's slow. It's slower, on the client, but it's not as noticeable where it's slower on the server and it's
really
noticeable. Yeah.
The way we get around this is by not having Fastboot do its thing as part of the request response cycle for a user, because it's going to take too long.
Right.
But the power of doing it once on the server and caching it, of course, is a well-known feature that is a feature of frameworks decades old. And so now we get to leverage that power. And so you can have Fastboot do its thing and it can take as long as it needs to. But if you cache it properly, then you really get benefits. So now that's what we're doing for users. And so embermap.com, the homepage, is the only page, as of the time of this recording, that's the only page that's going to be served from the cache, but it should feel super fast.
Right. And we're going to turn it on for other pages one by one.
Yep.
The nice thing is we cache multiple versions of the homepage, and then the first kind of load balancer or HTTP server that you hit of ours, we inspect your cookies, we know what type of user you are, we verify that with a backend service, and then we can serve the correct cache page. So if you're a subscriber, you get the subscriber page. If you're a user or anonymous user, you get that page. And it's surprisingly fast. It's way faster than I thought it would be. And it turns out this is also like a common programming model of backend services.
Yeah.
But
we didn't. It's pretty cool because our code also runs in the client.
Yeah.
I mean, using the same Ember app to do it is pretty amazing.
I think, you know, this stuff is like, there's a lot you have to understand.
Right.
With this, like the Fastboot side and the caching side.
Right.
But I can definitely see a path forward where you are writing a UI and you're not thinking about where this thing is rendering.
Right.
You're just thinking about the states that this thing can render in.
Right.
So I am rendering for a subscriber.
Right.
I might not know who that subscriber
is,
but I know that I'm rendering for a subscriber. Therefore, I can cache that, serve that page to all subscribers. But me as a developer, I'm writing my template as if it's for a subscriber.
Right.
And
I don't care about.
That's super awesome.
Super powerful.
Because even in like when I was doing like server rendered HTML, you're like, okay, I'm generating a bunch of HTML. Then I'm going to like open a JS file and do all this stuff in JavaScript. I know that's going to run on the client.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of like that dream of just,
mm-hmm.
Here's how my site works. Fastboot, Ember, figure it out. Figure out where you're running.
And that's awesome.
Stuff. Yeah.
I think we can talk maybe in another future episode more about the details, just because you have been working through the implementation this week and we've learned a bunch. But at kind of a high level, like, your feelings about Fastboot have kind of changed a little bit, in the sense that really the stuff that's talked about at EmberConf and comes with the libraries and everything seems like it's sometimes almost marketed as like a out-of-the-box answer. You need server rendering your Ember app, it's one Ember install away, and you're going to be good to go.
Yeah.
The reality is, it's not quite true, and you can feel let down when you start going down that path, and you can feel like, okay, what's going on here? But really, it is part of the story. It's just that it's really, instead of the whole story, it's really half the story, and the other half is this caching aspect.
Once you have the server rendered HTML, how do you serve it?
Right.
And it's tough. It's really tough to think of like an application server that you can't use at runtime.
Right.
Because like for the last, 30 years with HTTP, that's how we've thought of HTTP. I have an application server that I can count on at runtime.
Right.
And so it's different with Fastboot. But I think
it's not fast enough. At the end of the day, it's not fast enough.
It's not fast enough. It memory leaks. And, you as an application developer can go through and do all these things to clean up those memory leaks. But all it takes is one Ember add-on to violate one of these things. And they're really hard. They're like hard to know that you're memory leaking.
And you're also developing and testing in a client environment.
That's true. There's no way to run tests against Fastboot. You have to write something. And it's not super hard to write. I think Storefront uses add-on docs, and we test Storefront against server rendered add-on docs. So you can write it, but it's not the Ember testing story of
right.
like await visit, await click, which is just so unbelievably beautiful.
Right. We'll get there eventually.
Yeah.
I mean, what we need is Mirage to work in this.
That's another thing. Yeah. Mirage. Yep. Yeah. I think that's one of the first steps, getting Mirage working. Yep.
So, but that's cool to hear it working. And, we had some discussion on our Slack and community Slack about how folks are doing caching. It seems like this is kind of the same conclusion that a lot of people are coming to, is like, you have to nail the caching stuff. Of course, caching is difficult. So you have to think about how to like bust the cache and what depends on what. But that's why, thinking about Ember Map, it's nice that you can put users into these buckets, subscribers, anonymous people. And if you can render the template using just information from those buckets, and if you need something like a current user, you can just do that not in the initial render. And that way the cached page can be most of the page, and you'll get a huge benefit from that.
Yeah. I think if you're writing accounting software where the main screen is like someone's bank account with all their transactions, Fastboot, that's something you're not going to render in Fastboot, because it's going to be hard to cache that.
Right.
Your hit-to-miss ratio is going to be off, because
right.
it's basically everything's going to be a miss.
Right. So why go through the effort?
Yeah. I think you would do like some app shell thing where
right.
you render the app with like a skeleton screen in Fastboot,
right.
cache that, and then load in the user details once it hits a client.
But at that point, the shell part of your app is static. Doesn't depend on the database. Whereas with the caching stuff that we're talking about, the cached pages depend on your database, which is why it makes sense to have a server generate the
yep.
HTML. If you have a static part of your site that is, if most of it's specific to a single user, and then the 10% is just static, like it could live in Ember templates and not require any data, then you don't, the Fastboot stuff, I mean, there's other ways to, you could generate those with Prember at build time.
Yes.
Yep. Because those are not based on data. So the nice thing with the Fastboot thing, especially if it can be abstracted away and simplified, is that you can use the database to generate cache pages. So like Prember wouldn't work for us. I mean, okay, you could do it, but we don't want to do something like Prember because
we'd have to redeploy every time something changes.
Exactly. So now you can go in and change the title of a talk that's on the homepage of EmberMap and bust the cache and have a quick regeneration. And that's going to be easier and faster. Also, like if you're making lots of changes, then recrawling the entire site and rebuilding all the static files as that initial rendered page.
Yep.
But the Prember approach is nice for, there's lots of things it's nice for.
Yeah, right. The static content, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely.
So I think that's good to have those three options. And again, like Fastboot has the most complexity because you're going to be writing your own caching layer. But if we can get some solutions that are shared, it can get easier.
Yeah.
And at a high level, the architecture is something that you're confident in. Like you feel good about, like at a high level saying, run the Ember app in the server, cache the pages, have some way for sharing the data and busting the cache. I mean, it seems like a good approach, right?
Yeah, I think...
it needs to be battle-tested.
I don't know if like the architecture is the right word. It's like I believe in like the mental model.
Right.
As a developer, you can write a template without ever having to think about how it's being rendered, where it's being rendered.
Right.
And I mean that just seems huge because it seems like you can truly bend that curve, you know, the best of both worlds.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just thinking that, you know, we'll wrap it up here, but like we also talk about, you know, you're going through all this effort with Fastboot and you're like, you know, software like Rails that's made to do this, you get to avoid so much of the complexity, or it's just all taken care of for you and it's just faster because you don't have KVO, because you're doing something on the server and you don't have to worry about user interaction. If your Ember app ends up looking like something that could be built with Rails, we were talking how like you've kind of gone in the wrong direction, or like you should ask more from yourself, right? So like if embermap.com is like a site that just has links and forms and there's like basically no interactivity beyond that, there's something you're doing wrong in a sense. Or like we should be aspiring to more because we have the power of Ember animations, of prefetching data, of a cache on the client, of local storage, of offline mode, right? And so I think this stuff highlights that because it makes you realize that we're just reusing some of those architecture patterns from things that have been battle tested for a decade. But the real exciting part of it is you go to embermap.com and it just shows up, and then you start hovering things and they're moving. And by the time you click on it, it starts playing, and then you click on it and it full screens it. And it feels more like an iOS app than a website.
The fact that no server rendered web app, no server rendered web app can go through route transitions with animations.
Right.
And that seems, I mean, it seems really, really hard to do.
Right.
And this seems like I always like to think about we're doing all this work, we're getting Fastboot to render, like that's a lot of work. Especially,
yes,
like you said, it just works out of the box in Rails.
Yeah.
We're doing all this work, so what does it unlock?
Right.
And getting like animations across route transitions, it's a programming model of just always having like client-side JavaScript. I think those two things are huge. Those two things will show. Now we have a lot of work to get to do this,
but
that's where this is coming from.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, we talked about like most media sites, and you know, we've talked about this before, where like sites might have attention, where you have a public site like TED.com or New York Times, whatever. It's a media site. It's got to load fast. People tap a link from Twitter or Facebook and they need that thing to see their article quick, and then they go away. And, you know, having a client-side app for that feels like it could be weird. And a client-side app for something like you need a budget or accounting software makes more sense because you're in it for all day and you're caching everything. But again, with this stuff, you're talking really about bending the trade-off curve. And so if that media site could have a fast initial render, but then it's just going to feel much more app-like. And if you go now to like the App Store on iOS, it's beautiful. I mean, they have this feed and it doesn't look like a media website. It doesn't feel like a media website. You know, if you go to the news app on the iPad or the phone, I mean, there's a reason those things exist in apps, and media websites have never gotten to that point before. But like with this architecture, that you can, they can.
That's a great, great point. The Apple News app, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And yeah, how could you do that on a website?
And Rails, with Rails technology.
With Rails, with the same guarantees that a traditional web app news website has. So like edge caching.
Right.
Like super, super fast renders.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and I think we could. I think we can.
Yeah,
I think we're inching towards this.
Yeah. It's really cool. Really cool to think about. So awesome. If folks have questions for us that they'd like to have answered on the podcast, where should they go?
Embermap.com.
And do what?
Find an email address. Now they should go. We're in Topic Embermap on Ember Community Slack. We also have an Ember Slack for our subscribers. So if you're a subscriber, you should definitely join that. Or the website. There's you can tweet at us at Ember_map.
I know. I still want to get that at Embermap, but I haven't been able to yet.
If you work for Twitter, please help us.
So yeah, you can get in touch with us any of those ways. And we love answering questions on the podcast. We forgot to ask ahead of time this week, but we will next week. And that's it for this week. And thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
See ya.